Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, as well as WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Erica.
I'm Kaylin McPherson. Today, Mark Dunley talks with Peter Lavinia about the Green Party agenda for 2021.
Then we go to the Housing Justice press conference that was held this morning in response to four women being arrested for protesting a housing eviction back in October.
The press conference coverage is followed by an interview with one of the four arrested women, Shaquena, by HMM correspondent Alexis Goldsmith.
After that, we learn about a group that is keeping Albany in walking condition. President of Walkable Albany, Andrew Nedark, talks with HMM Daniel Platt.
And our show will close out with a conversation about the link between social and ecological issues. HMM Natalie Meltzer spoke with Blair Taylor from the Institute for Social Ecology. But first, here are some of today's headlines.
Under increasing criticism over the delay in distribution in distributing the COVID vaccine, including a backlog of hundreds of thousands of unused coronavirus vaccine doses, Governor Cuomo on Friday expanded the eligibility groups to include 3 million more people, including those 75 and older and frontline workers such as teachers and police. Medical providers can administer the vaccine to any of their employees who interact with the public if there are extra doses in a vial.
And our show will close out with a conversation about the link between social and ecological issues. HMM Natalie Meltzer spoke with Blair Taylor from the Institute for Social Ecology. But first, here are some of today's headlines.
The Times Union reports that Cuomo administration is refusing to turn over records that it used in a controversial report this summer, absolving itself of mishandling of COVID at nursing homes, which have accounted for many of the COVID-related deaths in the state. The Empire Center for Public Policy has also gone to court to force the Cuomo administration to provide data on the number of nursing home patients who died after being sent to a hospital.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi issued Vice President Mike Pence an ultimatum on Sunday night, invoking the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump in the coming days for his role in promoting an insurrection last Wednesday at the Capitol during the vote for a new president, or Democrats will proceed this week with an impeachment. The president for an unprecedented second time. Five people died in this insurrection, with the Capitol police officer who responded to the riots also committing suicide this weekend.
The Daily Gazette reports that the Schenectady City School District hopes to open its pre-kindergarten program next month for the first time this school year. Officials still did not commit to a broader rehiring of laid off staff or reopening school buildings to middle and high school students. The district had recently received its first payment under a state pre-kindergarten grant and was working to open the program to at least some students in February. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
To start us off today, on Monday, January 11th, Governor Cuomo delivered the annual State of the State Address. We talk with Peter Lavinia, co-chair of the Green Party of New York, about their vision for 2021, including the Green New Deal, tax the rich, single-payer health care, and marijuana legalization, with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Peter Lavinia, one of the co-chairs of the Green Party of New York State. And we're actually talking a few minutes before the governor's State of the State address. But we wanted to check with Peter. You know, the Green Party has technically lost its ballot status in New York because of the changes that Cuomo made to election law that they are suing in court. But they do remain, you know, a party at the state and national level. So Peter, what are some of the things that you're hoping to see the governor and the state legislature enact this year?
Thanks, Mark. Well, I would start with finding a way to tax the rich and to close a lot of the budget gap This has been talked about for most of the last year that we have a $15 billion budget hole. The Greens have been pushing things like the stock transfer tax for over a decade. Now, the stock transfer tax, as some of your listeners may know, is collected by New York State on every stock transaction on Wall Street, but immediately rebated to all of the stock purchasers. You know, this is something that's been going on since the early 80s, and it looks like we get about $15 billion a year from this stock transfer tax. That would close the budget gap right now immediately. So, you know, we had candidates run on this last year. Howie Hawkins, who was our presidential candidate last year, but gubernatorial candidate, three times, has run on the issue each time. You know, we are also trying to work in coalition with other groups around the state on that, and other tax-rich issues. We're talking about electoral reform. So not just trying to roll back the issues that that were passed in the budget last year that helped kick us off the ballot, but also things like ranked choice voting, proportional representation. We're talking about the Green New Deal, which many of your listeners may know was really first brought up in significant form by Howie Hawkins and then Jill Stein. We're talking about marijuana legalization and also single payer healthcare, which now that the Democrats have a supermajority in the Senate, we really do hope that we see many of these issues tackled.
Now, of course, the Democrats have had a majority in the state Senate, the legislature, mm-hmm. for the last 2 years. They've had the governor, Democrat, Andrew Cuomo, but yet the single payer failed to move the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Why is single payer still important, and, you know, how does it relate to, say, the COVID crisis?
Well, I think that what we've seen in the last year is a real an eye-opener for many people, the collapse of the employer-based healthcare system, as many, many people were pushed out of work because of COVID and because of job losses. They lost access to healthcare or easy access to healthcare. And many other people for years in New York State and around the country have not had access to adequate healthcare. So what we've been talking about for a very long time, the Greens have been at the forefront of this, is that we need a single payer system, right? Where the government provides healthcare to everyone regardless of your employment status. It would be cheaper. And in a situation like COVID, where you want people to have access to medical care and not worry about what it's going to cost to get tested or treated, single payer makes sense. In terms of why it hasn't passed, this is an interesting phenomenon, and it happened in California and I think Vermont, where Democrats have had the possibility of passing single-payer healthcare. They talk about it a lot before they get the chance to do it with majorities in the legislature. And once they have the chance to, they seem to get cold feet and back out. And I think a lot of us in the Green Party look at it as they're really being tied to the insurance industry and donations from that industry. This is, again, why we talk about the need for electoral reform.
Now, you mentioned the Green New Deal. Certainly, I know the Greens and others have been saying that any COVID relief package should focus on the Green New Deal. The governor said, well, listen, we passed the strongest climate law in the country, a year and a half ago. At the same time, Joe Biden, who is criticized for being too weak on climate, actually has proposals that are stronger than what New York has done. And just this weekend, Scott Stringer, who seems to be a leading candidate for mayor, mm-hmm. Came out with a pretty strong climate proposal for New York City, embracing a lot of the Green New Deal. So how does the Green Party and climate activists move forward on the Green New Deal, especially with, we still have another, 2 to 3 years before this climate panel actually comes up with recommendations for a plan?
Well, I think, first of all, scientists have been saying for a while now that we have until 2030 really to deal with this crisis. Last year, the New York State Legislature passed the CLCPA, which is a first step and an attempt to deal with the climate crisis. But we still think that it moves too slowly. We want to target data zero emissions as soon as possible by 2030. And what was passed last year gives that a 30-year timeline, which is far too late here in New York State. So what we really need to do is to put pressure on the legislature and the governor to move more quickly than the CLCPA tells them to do, because, the climate crisis isn't waiting around for political expediency. We really do need to say that we're moving to 100% clean electricity, by 2030. We need to, right now the CLCPA talks about 2040, I believe.
that's too late. We need to move to a zero emissions economy within the next 9 years. And I think that's only really going to happen with a mass movement, putting a lot of pressure on a legislature that has no more excuses, and Governor Cuomo, who claims to be, you know, a climate governor. So I think it's going to take mobilization, and it's possible, you know, given what we saw over the last year, what happened in lockdown, that emissions can go down if we really do something very radical, very rapidly, that, you know, we can mobilize a large portion of the population, just like we're trying to do to vaccinate. We can do the same in terms of a targeted plan for moving us away from fossil fuels.
Now, I remember back in 1998, when the Green Party first got ballot status in New York, you had Dr. Alice Green, Center for Law and Government, as the lieutenant governor candidate, Howie Hawkins running for state controller. But you also had Grandpa Al Lewis, you know, running for governor, got the 50,000 votes. And a big part of his focus was both getting rid of the Rockefeller drug laws, which somewhat has occurred, but also marijuana legalization, which you mentioned earlier. Now, Governor Cuomo, once again, for the third year in a row, has said, yeah, we're going to do marijuana legalization. But for the last 2 years, New York has failed to do that, even as surrounding states, you know, like Massachusetts, and I believe now New Jersey, have done it. What's the holdup? Why can't the Democrats come to agreement on a legalization? And what are some of the, you know, issues that the Greens are trying to push Cuomo and the Democrats on legalization?
You know, this is really an internal legislature fight. And I think a lot of people in New York State are starting to get very tired of it. You know, Cuomo says we need to legalize, the legislature says we need to legalize. And what they're wrangling over is where the money from the taxation is going to go. You know, the Greens have been saying for a very long time, the money that is collected from taxation of the legalization of marijuana needs to be put back into the communities that have been devastated by the so-called war on drugs. And it looked like the legislature was fighting with Cuomo over how much was going to go into those communities versus the general fund. And, you know, some of the other things that we've been talking about with marijuana legalization have been the question of how corporate this bill is going to be. You know, we would like to see home grow legalized, so you don't have to pay a corporation money like you would for cigarettes. We want people to be able to grow this at home. There are some other states where this happens. And we want to see the amount that's actually charged be such that, you know, we don't have to worry about a black market, right? So that there's money that's going into these communities where we don't continue to see people criminalized, you know, we can start to recover from this catastrophic so-called war on drugs that has devastated communities, start to rebuild really, but also to legalize something that really should never have been made illegal.
So we have about a minute left. You know, some people have made the idea that given some of the recent elections, you know, with some socialists getting elected in New York City or quasi-socialists, that in fact the legislature may shift to the left. You know, what's sort of your hope for sort of a socialist agenda in New York State? And in the last 30 seconds, if people want to get more information about the Greens, how to do that?
Yeah, look, you know, I'm a socialist. A lot of Greens are socialists. I really do hope, you know, people like Jabari Brisport, who is, you know, the hope from New York City, they push this agenda in the legislature. Unfortunately, you know, we've seen Democrats get elected time and again on platforms where they claim to do one thing and they move to the right. And so we'll see what happens. But, you know, I have hope. You know, in terms of getting involved, I would say, you know, you can, you know, take a look at gpny.org. If you want to see updates about the lawsuit, we, you know, regularly talk about it. I can just say right now that things will be moving forward, hopefully soon.
Well, we're out of time. Peter Lavinia, co-chair of Green Party of New York State, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Mark Dunley talking with Peter Lavinia about the Monday 11th State of the State address made by Governor Cuomo. Some of the topics they talked about was the Green New Deal, tax the rich, single-payer health care, and marijuana legalization.
At a hearing on Monday morning, three of four members of the Troy Eviction Defense Coalition, nicknamed the Geisenberg Four, pled guilty to trespassing charges incurred during a protest of what they say was an illegal eviction of a young Black mother in Troy. These protesters were also slapped with an order of protection from the landlord involved with the case. Michael Ginsburg, their attorney, Mark Mishler, called the order of protection insulting. Troy for Black Lives Matter held a press concert press conference this morning at Troy City Court after hearing. You will hear from the attorney Mark Mishler, members of Ginsburg for, and Keani Colony Wilson of Troy DSA.
All right. Good morning, everyone. So my name is Mark Mishler, and I was very proud and am very proud to represent what we call the Ginsburg Four, who are four very courageous people who have stood up in an act of moral courage in support of a young Black woman who was wrongfully evicted. And as a result of their courage and their standing up, they were arrested. So today, three of the Ginsburg Four resolved their cases. They entered guilty pleas to the non-criminal charge of trespass, which is a violation, it's not a crime. They were, the court imposed, as the court is required to under New York law, a court fee of $120. And the court also imposed, at the insistence of the district attorney's office, an order of protection prohibiting these individuals from having contact with Mr. Ginsburg. So, you know, their cases are resolved. The fourth case, there are some additional questions that we're going to continue to work on. That case is not resolved yet, and we will continue to work on that and try to make sure that Ms. Marquez Benbow's rights are fully protected moving forward. So, you know, this is, on some level, this is a fairly, could have been a fairly straightforward, simple resolution. Some people engaged in an act of civil disobedience. They did that based on the moral and political commitment that housing is a human right and that housing should be protected as a human right, and that in particular, under the circumstances that exist in our country right now, that the rights of Black people, and in particular a young Black woman, needed to be protected. And they showed enormous determination, courage, and principle by doing that. As sometimes happens in such cases, you know, there's a penalty to pay, because we exist within this legal system that imposes penalties on people who engage in principled acts of moral courage. And I'm very proud of Ms. Charles, Ms. Keefe, and Ms. Smith, who have shown determination, who are as determined as ever to stand up for housing as a human right, and are as determined as ever to stand for the principle that Black lives matter in every sense. And that, you know, this is a blip. You know, so they plead guilty to trespass. It's not going to adversely affect their lives. They will, I'm sure, continue to be committed, dedicated activists and leaders in these fights. So that's what happened. The issue of the order of protection was a distraction. There was no need for an order of protection. We attempted to persuade the district attorney's office to drop that requirement, and at least for now, they were not willing to do so. So their cases are over. They go on to continue their activism, continue their bold commitment to human rights, and that's what who they are, and that's what this is about. So I don't. So I don't know if there's any questions or who's going to speak. I don't know who.
I think, go for it.
First of all, Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter!
I feel, first of all, we wouldn't have to be here in the first place if Chastity was not illegally locked out of her own apartment with her child during a pandemic. Uh-huh. So I feel that what they are doing is over excessive. Even if we know that Ginsburg was acting out of, what is that? Like, just being malicious.
Yeah.
She was up on her rent. It was no reason for this to even happen. To, first of all, file an order of protection when the community say you are doing wrong, when the police were supposed to be there and said, hey, you can't lock her out of her own apartment. It's illegal. So us as a community, since the police did not do their job, us as the community went there and said, we're going to do it for you. Because if they're not going to do our job, their job, we're going to have to stand up for our people and do it for them. So I feel like us trespassing, or them so-called, the standards of trespassing, we would not be trespassing if they had did their job correctly.
That's right.
That's it.
Right.
That's all. We stand for chastity.
That's right. We stand for chastity. I don't know. I'm angry. Like, it was really hard to sit there and say that we were guilty. Like, I don't know. I'm speaking for myself. It was hard to sit there and say that I was guilty when, like, we didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly.
And I don't know, that bitch fucking put her hands on you and we got arrested? Like,
yes.
So that's how I feel. But I'm glad it's over. Yeah. And
I just want to say, first and foremost, that housing is a human right.
Hello.
And what happened to Chastity is not okay, but it continues to happen in this state, it continues to happen across this country. Just want everyone to know how serious, you know, that this city takes things. I was in this courthouse 2 years ago after getting out of a 4-year-long emotionally, physically, and sexually abusive relationship. They gave my ex a keep away order that was half the time of the one that I just received for trespassing. Mm-hmm. So where this city has its priorities, not in the right place.
Hello.
Unless someone else is ready to go.
So, good morning. My name is Kiani. I am the co-chair of the Troy DSA. I want to first thank Troy Black Lives and the General Defense Committee for inviting me to speak today. And I also want to thank all of y'all for showing up for housing justice in Troy today. So, in Troy, we're Troy DSA. We envision a Troy full of joy, safety, and equity. And we look through the future of the city. We do this by making housing affordable for all in the city. Housing is a human right, like folks have said earlier today, but we have so far to go to make this a reality in Troy. The current eviction moratorium is just a bandage on an existing issue that existed way before COVID. And when it ends, we will still have vulnerable people facing eviction and are difficultly paying rents due to underemployment or unemployment. Troy isn't doing enough to meet the housing needs of the people who live here. With more and more luxury apartments, buildings going up, it's clear that our city leaders care more about money than the well-being of the existing communities in Troy.
Gentrification.
Yes. And with that comes higher rents and more folks who are unable to pay their rent. So here's what we need to do in Troy to change this. First, we need to halt all evictions in Troy, not just for the tenants who have filled out a form. Second, we have to hold landlords accountable for bad actions, from harassing tenants to not making needed repairs to illegal evictions. It's absolutely absurd that the Ginsburg Four should be facing charges for protesting a tenant lockout, while the landlord who conducted the lockout does not face any consequences. We need to bring greater resources to tenant protection and advocacy in Troy. Unlike Albany and Schenectady, Troy, we lack a tenant advocacy organization. We need that. Our city council also needs to stop giving tax breaks to these luxury apartments and developers.
Hello.
Put that money into social services and folks
and things. Office to stay,
yep. And finally, we need to start taking the necessary steps to implement rent stabilization in Troy. It's essential that we act immediately to protect tenant rights in Troy and address our eviction and affordable housing crisis. If our leaders are unwilling to take the necessary steps, we must take the leadership ourselves and demand it.
Hello.
Did you know Jill's husband?
That was a hearing held on Monday morning where three of the four members of the Troy Eviction Coalition, nicknamed the Ginsburg's Four, pled guilty to trespassing charges incurred during a protest of what they say was an illegal eviction of young Black mother in Troy. These protesters were also slapped with the order of protection from the landlord involved with the case. Michael Ginberg, their attorney, Mike Misler, called the order of protection insulting. The Troy for Black Lives held a press conference this morning at Troy City Court. After the hearing, you will hear from attorney Mark Mesner, member of the Ginsburg Four, and Keani Colleen Wilson of Troy DSA. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Kalen. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more and to listen online about the Hudson Mohawk program, to listen online to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at themediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Four members of the Eviction Defense Coalition were in Troy City Court on Monday to plead trespassing charges relative an eviction defense case. This case is related to the tenant, lawyer, and landlord Michael Ginsburg. The Eviction Defense Coalition says the tenant was illegally evicted by having her locks changed. The tenant is a single Black mother with 3-year-old son. She has filed charges against Mr. Ginsburg for the unlawful eviction. But the Eviction Defense Coalition says the city of Troy has turned on the eviction defense instead. Sorry. In this segment, you will hear Shaniqua, an eviction defender and member of the Ginsburg Four, who pled guilty to trespassing charges with an order of protection. Shaniqua is followed by the member of the Eviction Defense Coalition and finally Cedric of the Community Rising Project.
I'm standing with Shaquina, who's one of the protesters that pled guilty today. What does this conviction mean for you?
I feel this conviction, the fact that I had to plead guilty, is a loss for me, because I feel like as the community, we should not be penalized for something that was already illegal doing. You understand what I'm saying? Like, for instance, why am I getting charges or have to pay a fine when you did something illegal? You know? Or why aren't you in court for illegally evicting a tenant during a pandemic? So it's just asinine to me, and I don't feel that is right that I have to pay a fine or because police or the landlord don't want to do their job properly. So I feel like it's a real injustice.
What was the DA originally trying to charge you with?
Well, it was always trespassing for me during the beginning. So I didn't get any protester charge.
And will this affect your decision to join future actions?
No. It will not. It actually helps me to go even further because that's an injustice by itself. So I feel as though if the community cannot say, hey, this is wrong, and just stand on property and tell you that this is wrong, that's shutting the community up and that's taking away our right. So,
you know, I don't know if this was asked before, but I asked this to your attorney, and the order of protection,
excessive.
I'm sure, which still continues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you don't want to be around Michael Ginsburg.
No.
So I'm interested in why you wanted it dropped.
Oh no, we didn't want the order of protection. He wanted the order of protection against us. So. I wish I felt that it was very excessive. That was the first time we ever met him or seen him or whatnot, and that's to tell him and everybody else, like, what you're doing is wrong. And me and my lawyer, our lawyer, has said that we're not going to run into you. You know, again, we're not going to seek you out. I felt like that he was trying to overreach and say that, he's scared of us type thing. And, you know, the court granted it. So, you know.
Yeah. Now, employment is very unfair, and I don't currently know what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But how does this affect you in terms of a mark?
Unemployment?
Yeah.
Well, I have to report to my job that, you know, I did go to court and I have an order of protection.
Yeah.
But I know for some of us that it affects the job, as in, like, slowing down income.
Especially with the economy.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And also, in terms of just your regular activism itself, how has this slowed things down? Because you've had to focus on this.
No, it didn't slow me down.
It didn't slow you down.
No, I did, you know, I stayed away from him or whatnot. I didn't bother him. I mean, and that was obsessive. Another thing that was obsessive during these 3 months that was happening, we didn't give you no indication that we was gonna ever bother you again.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? All we were saying is that what you're doing is wrong or whatnot. Unfortunately, I'm not able to say if you do anything else wrong, you know, that, you know, I can't say anything, but because I've been shut up. But it hasn't stopped my movement. It hasn't stopped the fact that I'm going to continue. Whenever I see injustice, I'm going to say something.
Yeah. And the other thing that I know that we talked on the day of, you didn't meet Chastity at that point, right?
No.
Have you met Chastity since?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How's that been?
She is, it's rough, you know, her going back and forth and then with her child until during this pandemic, but she's, I'm wishing her good wishes and stuff.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add?
Ginsburg should be brought up on charges for illegally evicting a mother and her child.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Serena.
You.
Black folks, people of color, the poor, queer folks. Accounts from tenants and media continue to highlight the negative impact allowing these evictions to move on unabated has. During the most memorable health crisis in the last century, evicted tenants are left to rely on shelters or the sheltering of them by friends or family, all which potentially increase their exposure to COVID and are in violation of the social isolation suggested by the CDC. These are issues that are compounded by the role of police brutality in this process. Many tenants victimized by evictions have been victims of police brutality. These same police are active members in their housing destabilization. The police often work directly with landlords to illegally carry out evictions. Something must be done to protect these tenants from the combined hardships brought on by evictions and police brutality. If the state cannot protect us, we must protect ourselves, as we have always done. We take care of ourselves.
Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
Housing is a human right. Shame on Troy, New York. Shame on Troy, New York. Shame on Troy, New York. Listen, we've been on the losing end in a time and space where peaceful protests and exercising of constitutional rights are determined by the tone of one's skin for far too long, right? We're talking about, we're sitting out here in the cold talking about an illegal eviction, right? Whatever we want to call it, we're talking about an illegal eviction, right? And then we're talking about four courageous individuals, right, that decided to stand up and say no more, right? No more. So we hear the chatter about what happened in Washington, about what happened in you know, all. I know what happened right here. I know what happened on October 20th, and that wasn't the first time. We seen the police turn their back on us so many times. We also seen it when an SUV came down and hit some protesters in front of the police. And the police did nothing. They did nothing. What they did do is they decided to turn their attention and their vitriol, right, on our black elders, on our black women, on our black and brown women. That's what they decided to do, right? This is what they always do, right? One of our greatest revolutionaries, right, Assata Shakur, she said, are you ready to sacrifice to end world hunger, to sacrifice to end colonialism, to end neocolonialism, to end racism, and to end sexism? And we can continue to go on and go on and go on. Another thing she said is she talked about revolution, right? And what is revolution? We need a revolution of the mind. We need a revolution of the heart. We need a revolution of the spirit. The power of people is stronger than any weapon. A people's revolution cannot be stopped, right? Revolution means the end of exploitation. Revolution means respecting people from other cultures. Revolution is creative. Revolution is also creative. courageous. Revolution is courageous. What these four individuals did was an epitome of courageous, right? We see a lot of us black and brown men sit on our couch and we play these video games, right? And we stand on the necks of our black and brown women, right? And we sit there and we say that we're gonna go out and we're gonna protect them. They don't need our protection. What they need, in my opinion, is somebody, right, to make sure they get what's promised to them.
We need support.
Right? That support, right? We don't need to, in our patriarchy, right, to stand on their necks. So I, as a black man, right, take my pulpit and stand here and say no more, right? How are we gonna support? How are we gonna look to the four and say, this is the epitome of courage and let us take their leadership.
Yes.
Let us take their guidance. Let us take their spirituality. Let us take their healing, right? And bring us to where we need to go. This is a revolution, right? Why not look to these four, right, that can understand the physiological nature of what the hell is going on to us and what has been going on since we was brought to this land, right? Asada Shakur said this, and I'll end. She said, nobody in the world, nobody in history, has ever gotten their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who are oppressing them, right?
Yeah.
So we must do it. Continue to do the things that we have been doing that's in our heart, that's in our spirit. Continue to fight. Housing is a human right. We are here for chastity, and we're here for these four strong individuals that's here to guide us.
Thank you.
You just heard from Shaquina, an eviction defender and a member of Gisenberg 4, who pled guilty to trespassing charges with an order of protection. Shaquina is followed by a member of the Eviction Defense Coalition, and finally, Cedric of the Community Rising Project.
Daniel Platt talks to the president of Walkable Albany, Andrew Neidhart, about the group is working and its post-Nor'easter relevance of the project organization Shovel Brigades.
Okay, so just introduce yourself and tell me and start by telling me about the initiative or the inspiration for Walkable Albany and so on. Tell me about it.
Sure. Yeah, so my name is Andrew Neidhart. I'm the founder of Walkable Albany, and it's an organization that committed to improving the safety for pedestrians in the city of Albany and also making sure there are lots of places worth walking to. So, you know, that means both things like crosswalks and it's improved street safety, but also making for increased density and making sure that neighborhoods are built in a way that people can choose to walk conveniently to get where they need to go.
Have there been any impacts of Walkable Albany as an interest group since you formed it?
Yeah, I would say we've had an impact in terms of changing the terms of the discussion on the land use end of things. We've weighed in on a lot of different projects around the city, and I think it's good for there to be a counterbalance when folks are always coming out to oppose projects and oppose things being built. It's good to have some folks part of the conversation who see that the path forward to financial stability for Albany includes more building, includes more people living here in the city and bringing our population back to some extent closer to what it was in the past. So we've been a part of changing that discussion. We've also advocated on the issue of beg button, and we've gotten the city to, in several different places, change the policy, at least to a sort of compromise solution that works for people. And we've also pushed for street safety in Washington Park, and as a result of that, the mayor is funding a traffic study of Washington Park. I think the RFP for that is going out fairly soon.
Sounds great. When did you start Walkable Albany as an underliner, and how many people have been involved so far?
So we've been around, I think it's a little over 2 years now, it's 3 years, sorry, and my number's wrong there. But we've been around for 3 years. We've gotten a little bit way late here during the pandemic, so it's been a fairly quiet summer for us. But you know, I would say our typical meetings, we get, you know, 10 to 12 people, but they're not the same people. So we have a lot of folks who are young parents and otherwise busy. And so we have a sort of rotating membership. Our mailing list of folks who are the most active is about 40 people. I think we have over 500 people on Facebook who follow our page. But the real core group is we have a board of about 5 members who do everything. And then I would say there's that sort of 20 to 30 really active members who are participating on a regular basis.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I went to a meeting myself probably 2 years ago.
I remember that. Yeah. Yes. After the Churchill article, I think.
I'm glad you're finding me memorable. in preparation for this winter and during the pandemic and a lot of mutual aid happening, you've started a new initiative. Can you tell me about it?
Sure. So, last year, there was a neighbor of mine who I didn't know before this, but he started a group of people through the Albany subreddit, and he called it the Albany Shovel Brigade. And a few of us went out and shoveled all of the crossings after that big snowstorm we had last year so that people could get into crosswalks. Because the crosswalks all get plowed in, you know, the day after the storm and then the day after and then the day after that. And so, you know, it's a big problem in the city, especially, you know, I experienced it personally as a parent who uses a stroller to get to daycare. But that, you know, that's easy enough for me. I have other solutions. But folks who are in wheelchairs, you know, the elderly who may have a hard time stepping over lots of snow, it's a big problem that our crosswalks are all completely blocked for sometimes weeks after a snowstorm. So this year, I kind of, you know, built on that idea that neighborhood had started, and we sort of formalized this as the Albany Shovel Brigade and asked for volunteers. So we have captains in several different neighborhoods who are going to be meeting up actually tonight to clear some corners, and hopefully we'll get a lot of volunteers out to come and help clear the corners and also bus stops. So that's our goal for tonight.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the kind of gaps that we kind of have when it comes to covering needs. So, like, sidewalks are usually considered the domain of personal responsibility or individual property owners. Meanwhile, roads and public, at least certainly sidewalks around public buildings, are then a public concern and from public plows. But then the curb cuts, which are both sidewalk and public, are left completely ignored. So right. It's something that, like, we as a community group have to fill in with. And that's kind of where there's the state or the government, then there's individual property, then there's this thing in between.
Right, exactly. And you know, from a legal point of view, technically the person who owns the property at that corner is supposed to do those curb cuts. The problem is they often do. So, you know, on my corner, there's an apartment building, right? Mm-hmm. They come and they do a great job clearing their snow the day after it snows. So right now, you know, here I am on Thursday, a little afternoon, it stopped snowing. So it's clear down there and they've cleared the curb cut. But, you know, 24 hours from now, it'll be filled in again because the plow will come through again. So a lot of times it's, you know, there's a lack of enforcement of the, it is supposed to be the property owner responsibility. But, you know, I think you hit on something important, which is that we leverage a mammoth amount of resources to get the streets clear, usually within 24 hours of a storm, right? It happens so fast that we're able to start clearing parking spaces immediately during snow emergencies, sometimes the next day after the storm. So the city's clearing parking spaces, you know, as a huge priority that we upend people's lives to accomplish. And then we still don't even have the sidewalks clear, you know, for sometimes weeks. So it does make you question the, you know, who are we really serving here? Who's the most important? You know, are we valuing someone with a car more than someone who needs to walk to the bus? You know?
Yeah, so it's a constant battle of rhetoric amongst neighborhood or Facebook groups or online chats. I see it constantly, even this morning. I saw a conversation or at least a thread where actually it's also the transit oriented meme pages also where you have, you know, kind of conversations of like the law, zoning, what does zoning have to do with racism? You know, what does, you know, and you can see the difference between neighborhood service as well, which has been a longstanding problem. So
right.
So any other comments or things about details about getting in touch with you or being involved with the Shovel Brigade or Walkable Albany?
Sure. Yeah. So to get more involved with Walkable Albany, the easiest thing to do is to like our Facebook page. It's called Walkable Albany. If that's not an option, or if you'd like to be even more involved, you can email us walkablealbany@gmail.com. We were having monthly meetings before the pandemic. It's kind of tapered off a bit, but we're hoping to bring some back, especially next year as we head into an election year for the city. So we're hoping to be a little bit active in that space. So if folks are interested in the Shovel Brigade, that's all posted on our Facebook page too. There are various locations and neighborhoods around the city. It's going to be at 7:30 tonight on Thursday. We have some captains all over the city and some other meetup spots where we'd like to see some volunteers get together. That would be the best way to find out is on the Facebook post.
This is definitely okay. For like the rest. This is going forward.
Yeah, going forward, yeah, just send us an email if you want to sign up. Or you can find a sign-up link where you can fill out a form to identify your neighborhood of interest it's a Google form. You'll find that on our Facebook page.
Cool. And you're not having any Zoom meetings yet?
We've had one so far. We kept it fairly limited to sort of see how it went, but we're expecting to have one sometime in January.
Okay. So yep. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining me, and be well.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Daniel Plate. Talks to the president of Walkable Albany, Andrew Nidart, about the group, its work, and its post-Northeast relevant project of organizing shovel bridges.
For our final segment tonight, social ecology is a philosophical outlook which asserts that ecological problems arise from social problems, and therefore ecological problems cannot be resolved without addressing problems within society. Blair Tyler from the Institute for Social Ecology speaks with HMM Natalie Meltzer about how this philosophy has informed social movements both past and present. For more information, go to social ecology, visit social-ecology.org.
I'm here with Blair Taylor from the Institute for Social Ecology to discuss the relationship between ecological and social issues. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Blair Taylor, and I'm the program director of the Institute for Social Ecology. I've been involved with the Institute for Social Ecology since about 2000, when I first came to a summer program in Vermont in the aftermath of the 1999 battle in Seattle, the anti-WTO demonstrations in Seattle, which is near my hometown, and I was living in Seattle at the time, which social ecologists played a very big role in. We're a popular education center and think tank, historically based in Vermont, although we're also now decentralized and spread throughout the globe. I currently live in Bremerton, Washington, just outside Seattle.
What exactly is social ecology?
That's a big question. Our co-founder, Dan Chodorkoff, who co-founded the Institute in 1974 with Murray Bookchin, who's a pretty well-known political philosopher and environmental thinker, Dan likes to often say it's hard to boil it down to a bumper sticker, but we can say that at its core, social ecology is a way of looking at the world that understands social and ecological problems as deeply intertwined and interrelated. In contrast to kind of mainstream environmentalism, which sees environmental problems as kind of a technocratic thing that needs to be solved through, you know, individual consumption changes and maybe market-driven carbon taxes, things like that, social ecology contends that you can't really solve the environmental problems unless you look at how they emerge from the way we organize our society in a deeply hierarchical, racist, and capitalist society. That these things you can't have an ecological society and a deeply hierarchical society. So the core insight is that the ecological crisis is a social crisis. So it's good to, you know, shorten your showers and recycle and things like that. But if we really want to solve these problems, we have to really restructure how our society is organized and rearrange it as an egalitarian democratic society where the imperative to dominate nature is no longer there.
How have you seen the reception of social ecology change in the 20 years that you've been involved with the ISC?
That's an interesting question. I mean, social ecologists and the ideas of social ecology have been very active in many of the major social movements of the last 40 years, from you know, the early green movement and including, you know, the development of the Green Party, which eventually, because social ecology articulates a kind of anti-statist, anti-party politics, kind of split different ways, but in the grassroots anti-nuclear and intersectional peace, feminist, ecological justice movements of the 70s and 80s. And then in the radical ecology movement of the 80s and 90s, in the altered globalization or global justice movement of the 90s and early 2000s, which is really when I came of age. And then later in the Occupy Wall Street movement. And then of course, you know, in contemporary Black Lives Matter movement, Right to the City movements, a variety of movements that are essentially, you know, offering a critique of all forms of hierarchy, all forms of domination, all forms of oppression, and are linking that to a vision of an anti-capitalist and directly democratic world where we're not governed over by a ruling class of representatives, but where we take matters into our own hands, where we run society and social matters ourselves. So it's a constellation of ideas of direct democracy, a critique of capitalism, a desire for an ecological society. That, you know, it's interesting because, you know, being there for 20 years now, I can see that kind of it ebbs and flows in relation to social movements. And what many people tell us when they come and take our classes or take one of our workshops or organize with us is, you know, these are the ideas that I always had. This is the kind of world I always wanted to see. And I just never knew there was a name for it. So that's a very common response. Another movement I neglected to mention that it's really put social ecology back on the map, of course, is the Movement for Democratic Confederalism or Kurdish Autonomy in Rojava, which, you know, there's an interesting backstory there of the leader of the PKK, which was at one point in time a fairly traditional Turkish Marxist national liberation movement. When their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, was imprisoned, he started reading different thinkers, including Murray Bookchin, and completely reframed his ideas. Because Kurdistan, you know, it spans several nations in the Middle East. It doesn't really make sense to argue for their own distinct nations. So they started using the ideas of social ecology to argue for a directly democratic, non-hierarchical polity in the Middle East. And so that's actually also given social ecology a lot of visibility in recent years. And a lot of young people are inspired by the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan, which is, you know, one of the bright spots in the Middle East where, you know, famously, they helped defeat ISIS. They were our military allies until they were abandoned, more or less. And they've, you know, are a women-led, feminist, multi-ethnic, secular, and democratic, and ecological society they're trying to build in the middle of a war zone and under constant threat by Turkey. So that's another tributary that comes into and informs people that are interested in social ecology.
For those listening, you know, are there ways that you suggest that they can learn more about social ecology? Are there actions that they can take?
Yeah, there's a very exciting new organization that was founded in the last couple of years that grew out of ISE programs called the Symbiosis Network. And they're a North American and hopefully at some point global confederation of people that are trying to put these ideas into practice, that are building mutual aid networks in their local communities to help each other, to build alternative parallel structures that exist outside of capitalism in the state that can meet our needs in a more direct and more fulfilling way. They're all over the place. There's groups like Olympia Assembly in Olympia, Washington. There's groups in Detroit, Demand Utopia in Portland. There's a Black Socialists of America, Cooperation Jackson. And Jackson has been doing really incredible work for a long time of building what we call dual power, building a democratic infrastructure that will eventually replace the very hierarchical, destructive one that we have. I would also, of course, say, check out the Institute for Social Ecology. We offer online seminars, a variety of different educational programs. We have a new one starting very soon in January called Ecology, Democracy, Utopia, which is an overview of social ecology that talks about the nature philosophy, the analysis of hierarchy and domination, movement history and organizing strategy, and the need for a reconstructive utopian vision, because that's really one of the core insights of social ecology is we all know what the problems are, we've known for a long time, but we need to offer an alternative institutional infrastructure that can replace what we have now. It's not enough to just critique, although that's very, very important. So check out some of these classes, check out some of these organizations, and try to build community power. Get to know your neighbors, organize around shared interests. you know, read some works by Murray Bookchin and other affiliated thinkers to, you know, sharpen our understanding of the nature of the problems, because, you know, social ecology is very interested in theory. It's important to understand the nature, the analysis of the problem will direct you in better or worse ways. So we need an emancipatory response to the intersecting social, environmental, racial, political crises that are facing us. It's a huge task, but it's one that, you know, revolutionaries for centuries have tried to accomplish, and we need everybody on board.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Blair. This was a great conversation.
It was very nice chatting with you, Natalie.
That was Blair Taylor from the Institute for Social Ecology spoke with HMM's Natalie Meltzer about the philosophical outlook, which asserts that ecological problems arise from social problems. For more about social ecology, visit social-ecology.org. That concludes our show, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Erica.
And I'm Kaelin McPherson. Our engineers are Alexis Goldsmith, as always, and our newcomer. And I am very happy. She's doing her best. Sina Bazilel Hickey. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get the dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, a comment on our work, or even a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you are interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.
I'm Chris Matthews. I'm a social justice singer-songwriter based in the D.C. area. You are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.